content. The sulky, shapeless look of youth was upon his mouth. The hare-lipped scar was deepening, seeming to pulsate, opening and closing a little with some perhaps unconscious, lifelong, habitual movement. His hair was extremely tangled and untidy. "Titus?"
"Yes?"
"Can you call me Charles? Could you get used to it? I feel it would help us both."
"Okay,
Charles." "Titus, you are very important to me, and I need you—" Titus worked at his scar, then put a finger on it to stop its little quivering. It only then occurred to me that Titus might have been reflecting on those ambiguities in our relationship which struck Gilbert so much, might indeed have been put in mind of them by some crude jest of Gilbert's. I had not thought of this fairly obvious idea before, partly because I had been distracted from Titus, partly because I had somehow spread over him a canopy of innocence which derived from the suffering Hartley. "Don't misunderstand me," I added. Titus's moist, discontented mouth twitched in a smile or sneer. I went on. "I want to tell you something." I had suddenly decided that I must tell Titus about Ben's attempt to kill me.
"If it's about Mary?"
"Yes." I had not talked to Titus since the awful scene at Niblett's, when the delegation brought the erring wife back to the hateful husband.
"All that makes me sick. I'm sorry, forgive me, but I just don't want to be involved. I left home so as not to be bothered with muddles like that. I hate muddles, and I've had them all my life with those two. Muddle, muddle, muddle. They're not bad people, really. They've just got no sense of how to live a human life."
"She's not a bad person, I agree.
I can't tell you how sick I felt when we went over to their place in the car. I wish to God I hadn't come and seen it all. Now I'll never forget it. I felt so humiliated. Mary was being treated like a bit of property, or a child. You mustn't interfere in other people's lives, especially married people. That's in a way why marriage is so awful. I can't think how anyone dares do it. You've got to leave them alone. They've got their own way of hating each other and hurting each other. They enjoy it."
"If it's so awful, one ought to interfere. You mustn't be so cynical and pessimistic."
"I'm not cynical and pessimistic. That's the point. I don't care. You think I think about it. I don't. I don't want to see. I don't want to know. I don't care a fuck about their bloody misery."
"Well, I do, and I'm going to get your mother out of it. I'm going to get her right out."
"You tried, and she just squealed to go home. I'd have let her walk."
"Sorry, I don't mean that. You made a mistake, that's all. Now forget it. Honestly, I can't understand why she'd want her. I mean, I can't see it. Is it sentimental or Salvation Army or something? You can't want someone like that. I don't see it. I don't get the point. There's that woman Lizzie Shearer who seems to like you a lot. And Rosina Vambra.
I happen to love your mother."
"Oh, love?
You mean you may be too young to understand.
I suppose it's natural for me to be interested in girls in a normal way. When you're old, I dare say it may be different."
I was stiff and bruised. It had been foolish to come so far. I was feeling tired, weak, and exasperated. Titus's sheer youth, his unspoilt, youthful, hopeful strength annoyed me to the point of screaming. His long, bare, brown legs, covered with reddish hairs, emerging from his roughly rolled-up trousers, annoyed me. I felt I was losing touch with him. I'd be sharp with him, and then be reduced to making an appeal.
"I'm sorry it all upsets you, sir. I partly understand. But I do want your help. Well, your support. And I want to tell you something rather important about your father.
About Ben, not my father. God knows who my father is. I'll never know. Look, don't let's talk about Ben. He bores me. I'm not happy about this thing."
"What thing are we on to now?"
"This thing between you and me. Let's forget about them. Let's talk about you and me."
"Okay, I want to talk about that too."
"Titus, I'm not trying to kidnap you."
"Yes, I know. We're free, we two, in relation to each other. There's no need to define things."
"Father is a definition, I should think."
"It's an idea. Let's just be friends, if you prefer it. Let's wait and see. You know, there's nothing sort of sinister here. You know what I mean."
"Oh, I know that.
I just want to feel that there's a bond, a special relationship, a special connection.
I don't see why, said Titus.
Sorry, I'm being ungrateful. And I've been here and eaten your food and drunk your drink, I know, but I've been thinking. After all, why should you bother about me? If you'd been my real father, great. Though even then... Well, anyway, what I wanted to say was this. I've enjoyed meeting you. I've enjoyed being here, in spite of the horrors. Later on I'll maybe think, that was a good time. Yes, good. But I want to earn my own living and lead my own life, and I want to do it in the theatre. I'm not a silly stage-struck kid. I don't imagine I'll be a star. I don't even know yet if I'll be any good at acting. But I want to work with theatre people. I guess that's my scene. This place is fine for a holiday, but I want to get back to London, where the real things happen.
Don't real things happen here?
Oh, you know what I mean. Where does your cousin live?
In London.
Again, the bite of the serpent of jealousy. Had James got Titus on a lead?
There seemed to be a bond between them from the start. I said quickly, please don't talk to any of the others about, you know.
Of course not, not a word. You don't have to say that, for Christ's sake.
Good.
The thing is, I don't want you to feel any special obligation to me.
If you have obligations, I'll have to have obligations.
I don't want to live here at your expense any longer. I want to get cracking. I don't mind your helping me a bit if you like. Maybe you could help me get into an acting school. If I could get a place in a school, I could get a grant, and I'd be independent. Maybe it's a bit of a fiddle to ask you to get me in, but I don't mind fiddling that much. Then I can be on my own, and we can be friends, or whatever you want. But I've got to be on my own, see?
How weak and helpless I felt before that brutal, innocent, free power. He would wriggle away before I had even learnt how to love him, or learnt the trick of holding him.
Yes, I'll help you into an acting school, but we'll have to think about it. I'll come with you to London later on. Meanwhile, maybe you can help me here. But I want to tell you something about Ben, something that you ought to know. You say he's not a bad person, but he is. He's a wicked, violent man. He tried to kill me.
I wanted to impress Titus, and to shake his appalling detachment.
To kill you? How?
He pushed me in. I didn't fall accidentally into that sea-hole. He pushed me. Titus showed little emotion. He leaned forward, scratching an insect bite on his ankle.
Did you see him?
No, but I felt him.
How do you know it was him?
Who else could it have been? He said he'd kill me the last time we met.
I can't imagine him doing that. It's not in character. It's most unlikely, said Titus, in a maddeningly bovine manner.
I was pushed. Someone pushed me in the back.
Are you sure? You could have fallen backward on a rock, and then slipped into the water, and it would feel like being pushed.
You'd had some drinks, you know, and the doctor said you might be a bit confused about the whole business afterwards. I felt too tired and wretched to go on. It was foolish to have walked so far.
All right, Titus, let's leave it there. Don't repeat what I've said to anyone.
Titus looked at me out of his narrowed, stone-coloured eyes.
You see, it's not so much fun as you expected, playing at fathers and sons.
This was the kindest thing he had said.
I said, I'll help you about acting school. We'll talk of that later. Now bugger off, will you?
He got up.
I must help you back.
I can manage.
You can't. Besides, it's beginning to rain.
He held out his hand. I took it and he pulled me up, and then still held me.
He said, we'll get to know each other one day. There's time.
There's time. Hartley, dearest, listen to me. I want to say several things. First, that I am sorry I took you away like that and kept you with me. It was an act of love, but I now see that it was foolish. I frightened you and confused you. Forgive me. It was at least a demonstration that I care absolutely and am in earnest about taking you away. You belong to me, and I am not going to give you up. So you will be seeing me again soon. I expect you have been thinking things over since you got back, and may now see them a little bit more from my point of view. After all, my darling, why stay in the land of unhappiness? It isn't as if I were a stranger offering you someone and something you know nothing of. You said yourself I was your only friend. And you seemed, when you were here, almost ready to say yes.
only you were frightened of him. Fear is a habit, after all. But do you not feel in your heart now that you are changing? One day soon you'll be able to do what you've wanted to do for years. Walk out of the door. And listen, I want to tell you this. I don't want to take you into some grand, glamorous world full of actors and famous people. I don't live in that sort of world anyway. You said you liked a quiet life. Well, so do I. That's why I came here, after all. We'll go away, just the two of us, and live simply in a little house in a little place, in England, in the country, near the sea, if you like, and we'll make each other happy in simple ways. That's the life I've always wanted. And now I'm free of the theatre, I can have it at last, with you. We'll live quietly, Hartley, and enjoy simple things. Can you not want that sufficiently, to walk out of a house where you are bullied and unloved? And, of course, we shall help Titus, and he will come to us in freedom, and all those old scars will heal. We shall care for him. But what will always matter most is you and me. Now, I want to tell you something else, something rather terrible. 2 nights ago, Ben tried to kill me. He pushed me off the rocks in the dark into a frightful tide race. God knows how I managed to survive it. I've got concussion and am generally knocked about. I've been seeing the doctor. But don't worry, I'm all right. Attempted murder is not the sort of thing which one can quietly ignore and carry on as if nothing had happened. I have not yet been to the police. Whether I go to them or not depends on Ben. I should add, a very material point, that there was a witness of what happened. However, I am not concerned about revenge. I simply want to take you away. Apart from anything else, you surely cannot want to stay with a man who has proved himself capable of murder. Just stop wanting to suffer, will you? And please start sorting out your things, deciding what clothes to take with you and so on. I'm not going to hurry you, but now I am going to be around the place. I'm going to be a regular intruder. I shall tramp in and out. If Ben objects, he can either consent to your departure or force me to go to the police. This isn't blackmail. It's a fair field at last. No need to tell Ben about this unless you want to. I'll be along pretty soon on the heels of this letter, and I'll tell him myself. As my death hasn't been announced, he will know by now that he is not a murderer. Relax, darling, and don't worry. And now leave it all to me. Sort out those clothes. I love you. We'll be together, dear one. See. I had considered writing directly to Ben, but it seemed better to prepare Hartley first. The difficulty was, once more, how to get it to her. I did not want to risk spoiling my entrance by delivering it myself. I did not like to ask Titus to go, and Gilbert, whom I sounded, said he was afraid. And I did not want James, or Lizzie, or Peregrine, for that matter, to know anything about it. I thought of sending it by post in a typed envelope, but of course he opened all her letters. Perhaps it did not matter too much if he opened this one. The game was nearing its end. It was the following day, and I had written my letter in the morning, but was still undecided about what to do with it. It remained now to get rid of James and Lizzie. I could simply ask James to go. Lizzie might have to be told some lie. James was, rather surprisingly, still in bed. He had slept on and off for many hours, whereas I, who had had the real ordeal, was now feeling better. I went up to see him. "James, you slug, are you all right? Touch of the old malaria?" James was lying back in my bed, propped up in a cunningly arranged nest of pillows, his arms stretched out straight over the blankets. He had not been reading. He looked alert, as if he had been thinking. Yet his body looked floppy with relaxation. He had some growth of beard which changed his face, making him look Spanish, an ecclesiastic, perhaps an ascetic warrior. Then he smiled cheerfully, and I remembered how much that inane smile used to irritate me, how it had seemed to betoken a facile superiority. There was quietness in the room, and the sound of the sea was dulled. "I'm all right. Must have caught a chill. I'll get up soon. How are you feeling?" "Fine. Can I get you anything?" "No, thanks. I don't want to eat. Lizzie brought me some tea." I frowned. "Where's Titus?" said James.
"I've no idea."
"Keep an eye on him."
"He can look after himself."
There was silence for a moment. "Sit down," said James. "Don't look as if you're going."
I sat down. James's relaxation seemed to have affected me. I stretched out my legs and felt as if I might sleep myself, even though I was sitting in an upright chair. I felt my shoulders and arms become soft and heavy. Of course, I was very exhausted.
"You're not still wanting Titus to go back to Ben, are you?" I said.
"Did I say that?"
"You implied it."
"He does, in a way, belong with them."
"With them?"
Soon, very soon, there would be no more them. James, following this, said,
"Are you still dreaming of that rescue?"
"Yes." There was another silence, as if we were both going to sleep. Then James went on,
"After all, he is in a real and deep sense their child. My impression was that that relationship was not beyond salvage."
I was irritated by his impression.
What could it be based on?
The horrible answer occurred to me, conversations with Titus. I had come up to see James in order to hasten his departure, and I had decided not to say anything to him about Ben's crime. This revelation would be too interesting. But now I felt tempted to shake his complacency. While I reflected on this, I said, "I am going to adopt Titus."
"Adopt him, legally, can you?"
"Yes. In fact, I did not know. I am going to make his career, and I shall leave him my money."
"It's not so easy."
"What isn't?"
"To establish relationships. You can't just elect people. It can't be done by thinking and willing."
I was tempted to reply, "I dare say you don't find it easy." Then I recalled Titus's voice, saying, "Where does your cousin live?" And I remembered what Toby Ellesmere had told me about the Sherpa whom James was fond of, who died on the mountain, and I felt a momentary nervous urge to ask him about this attachment. But it would have been a dangerous impertinence. I was never unaware that James retained the power to hurt me very much. How odd it was that even now my fear was an ingredient of our converse.
Cuisinage. Dangereux voisinage.
I felt annoyance with him all the same. He was making me feel awkward and incompetent, and I wanted to stir up his sleepy calm. I could not decide whether or not to tell him about Ben. If I told him, would that delay his departure? Yet I very much wanted to tell him. It is indeed awe-inspiring to think that every tiny action has its consequences, and can mark a parting of ways which lead to vastly separate destinations. James said, pursuing the topic,
"Most real relationships are involuntary."
"As in a family, what you were saying about Titus?"
"Yes. Or sometimes they just seem destined. A Buddhist would say you had met in a previous life."
"Would you say you were a superstitious man? And don't say it depends what you mean by superstition."
"In that case, I can't answer you."
"Do you believe in reincarnation? Do you think that if one hasn't done well, one will be reborn as a hamster or a woodlouse?"
"These are images. The truth lies beyond."
"It seems to me a creepy doctrine."
"Other people's religions often seem creepy. Think how creepy Christianity must seem to an outsider."
"It seems so to me," I said, though I had never thought this before. "Do Buddhists believe in life after death?"
"It depends."
"Oh, all right."
"Some Tibetans," said James, "believe—"
He corrected himself. He now always spoke of that country in the past tense as a vanished civilization.
"Believed that the souls of the dead, while waiting to be reborn, wander in a sort of limbo, not unlike the Homeric Hades. They called it Bardo. It can be rather unpleasant. You meet all kinds of demons there."
"So it's a place of punishment?"
"Yes, but a just, automatic sort of punishment. The learned ones regard these figures as subjective visions which depend on the sort of life the dead man has led."
"For in that sleep of death what dreams may come."
"Yes."
"But what about God? Or the gods? Can't a soul go to them?"
"The gods? The gods themselves are dreams. They too are merely subjective visions."
"Well, at least one might hope for some happy illusions hereafter."
"Just possibly," said James,
with a judicious air, as if he were discussing the likelihood of catching a train. "But very few people are without attendant demons."
"And does everybody go to Bardo?"
"I don't know. They say that you have a chance at the moment of death."
"A chance?"
"To become free. At the moment of death you are given a total vision of all reality which comes to you in a flash. To most of us this would be, well, just a violent flash, like an atom bomb, something terrifying and dazzling and incomprehensible. But if you can comprehend and grasp it, then you are free."
"So it's useful to know you're going. You mean free to—"
"Just free. Nirvana. Out of the wheel."
"The wheel of reincarnation?"
"The wheel, yes, of attachments. Cravings, desires, what chains us to an unreal world."
"Attachments? You mean even love?
What we call love."
"And do we then exist somewhere else?"
"These are images," said James. "Some say Nirvana is and can only be here and now. Images to explain images. Pictures to explain pictures.
The truth lies beyond."
We were silent then for a little time.
James's eyelids dropped, but I could still see the glint of his eyes. I asked jocosely, "Are you meditating?"
"No. If I were really meditating, I would be invisible. We notice each other because we are centres of restless mental activity. A meditating sage is not seen."
"Yes. Distinctly creepy." I could not make out whether James was serious. I presumed he was not. The conversation was making me feel thoroughly uncomfortable. I said, "When do you plan to leave? Tomorrow, I imagine? Apart from anything else, I want my bed back."
James said, "Yes, I'm sorry, you can have the bed tonight. I'll push off tomorrow. I've got a lot of things to do in London. I have to prepare for a journey." So my guess had been right. James had not really left the army, he was going secretly back to Tibet. I wanted to indicate tactfully to him that I knew.
"Oh, a journey, of course. I think I can imagine. However, I ask no questions."
James was silent,
now looking at me out of his dark, unshaven face and his dark eyes. I glanced quickly at him and looked away. I decided to tell him about Ben. "You know, James, about my falling into that hole."
"Min's cauldron, yes."
"I didn't fall accidentally. I was pushed."
James considered. "Who pushed you?"
"Ben."
"You saw him?"
"No, but somebody pushed me, and it must have been him."
James looked at me thoughtfully. Then he said, not at once, "Are you certain? Are you sure, A, that you were pushed, and B, that it was Ben?"
I was not going to be A'd and B'd by James. Nothing seemed to touch him, not even attempted murder. I just thought I'd tell you. "Okay, forget it. So you're going tomorrow, that's fine." At that moment I heard a sound which I shall never forget. I sometimes hear it still in daylight hallucinations. It tore into my consciousness with its own immediate evidence of some frightful event, and the room was filled with fear as with fog. It was Liz's voice. She shrieked somewhere out in front of the house. Then she shrieked again. James and I stared at each other. James said,
"Oh, no."
I rushed out, got entangled in the bead curtain, and began to tumble down the stairs. I ran panting across the hall, and then at the front doorway nearly fell, as if a dense cloud of weariness and despair had met me and all but made me faint. I could hear James running down the stairs behind me. Something extraordinary seemed to be happening on the road. The first person I saw was Peregrine, who was standing beside Gilbert's car and looking along the road in the direction of the tower. Then I saw Lizzie, leaning on Gilbert's arm, walking slowly back towards the house. Up near the tower there was a car and a group of people standing looking down at something on the ground. I thought, there's been a road accident. Peregrine turned, and I shouted at him, "What's happened?" Instead of replying, he came forward and tried to grasp my arm and detain me. But I shook him off. James was now at my heels.
He was wearing my silk dressing gown, the one that Hartley had worn. He too said to Perry, "What's happened?" I paused. Peregrine said, "To James, not to me." "It's Titus." James went up to the yellow Volkswagen and leaned against it. He mumbled something like, "I should have held on." Then he sat down on the ground. Peregrine was saying something to me, but I ran on towards the corner, passing Lizzie, who was now sitting on a rock, with Gilbert kneeling beside her. I reached the group of people. They were strangers, and they were looking down at Titus, who was lying on the grass verge. But he had not been hit by a car. He was drowned. I cannot bear to describe what happened next in detail. Titus was already dead, there can be no doubt of that, although I did not want to believe it at once. He looked so whole, so beautiful, lying there, limp and naked and dripping, his hair dark with water. Someone had drawn it away from his face, and his eyes were almost closed. He was lying on his side, showing the tender fold of his stomach and the bedraggled wet hair of his front. His mouth was slightly open, showing his teeth, and I remember noticing the hare lip. Then I saw a dark mark on the side of his forehead, as if he had been struck. I ran back towards the house, shouting for James. James was still sitting on the ground beside the car. He got up slowly. "James! James! Come! Come!" James had revived me. Surely he could revive Titus. James looked dazed and ghostly. Peregrine had to assist him to walk. "Oh, quick, quick, help him!" By the time James reached the corner, one of the strangers—they were tourists—was already attempting to do something. He had turned Titus over onto his front and was rather ineffectively pressing his shoulders. Peregrine said, as if speaking for James, "Kiss of life is better." James knelt down. He seemed unable to speak and motioned that Titus should be turned over again. There was a moment of confusion, several people talking at once, then the sound of a police siren. It turned out later that a car on the way to the Raven Hotel had taken the news on, and the hotel had rung the police. A brisk, efficient policeman took charge, told us to stand back, began himself to attempt mouth-to-mouth respiration. An ambulance arrived. James went away and sat down on the grass. A policeman began to ask Peregrine and me if we knew who Titus was. Peregrine answered his questions. It appeared that the tourists, going to bathe from the rocks in Raven Bay, had seen Titus's body being carried by the tide round the corner from the tower, and they had swum out and pulled it ashore. There was nothing anyone could do. Men put Titus on a stretcher and slid him into the ambulance. Several cars had stopped. The police car went away to go to Niblett's to inform the parents. The verdict of the inquest was death by misadventure. Titus died from drowning after a blow on the head. It was assumed that a wave had dashed him against a rock. What exactly had happened was never clarified. However, by then it had become dazzlingly clear to me that Titus had been murdered. We had to do with a homicidal madman. The hand that had failed to strike me down had succeeded in striking him. But I spoke of this, for the time, to no one. Titus's body was conveyed to a hospital in a town many miles away, and was there received into the merciful anonymity of cremation. History 6 It was a short time later. Time had passed for me in a haze of misery and bitter remorse, and the resolutions of hatred. Gilbert had to go back to London to act in a television play. Lizzie stayed, and I got used to her unhappy face, reddened with crying. Peregrine stayed, but boorishly, almost angrily. Dressed in tweed trousers, shirt and braces, he walked inland every day into the country near Amorne Farm, and arrived back hot and irritable. He was obviously wretched, but seemed unable to drag himself away. Once or twice he drove Lizzie to the village for shopping. James stayed, but was very withdrawn. He was gentle and considerate to me, but had little to say. We remained together, though we could not talk to each other, out of some sense of mutual protection. Of course they did not want to leave me alone. Perhaps each intended to be the last to go.
It was as if we were all waiting for something. Lizzie did the cooking. We lived on pasta and cheese. It was impossible to return to the ordinary feasts and festivals of human life, the meals to which people looked forward and which they enjoy. We all, except James, drank a lot. On the day which I shall now describe, I woke up in the early morning and realized I had had a terrible, terrible nightmare. I had dreamt that Titus was drowned. I experienced the relief of the awakening dreamer, and then remembered. I got up and went to the window. It was about 6 o'clock, and the sun had been up for some time. Cool summer weather had come back with a misty sky and a calm sea. The water was a very pale, luminous grey-blue, almost white, the same colour as the sky, shifting with a quick, small dancing movement, and scattered by the misted sun with little explosions of metallic pale gold light. It had the look of a happy sea, and I felt I was seeing it through Titus's eyes. I had returned to my own bedroom. The other three, though I disliked their proximity to each other, slept downstairs. I had decided that today I would tell them all to go. I felt strong enough now to do this, and although in a way I dreaded to be alone, my plans demanded solitude. I dressed quickly and went downstairs to the kitchen. Peregrine was there shaving. He ignored me, and I went through onto the lawn. James was just climbing down from the rocks. A moment later I could hear Lizzie talking to Peregrine. We were all early risers on that day. James sat down on the natural seat beside the trough where I put the stones I collected, or rather used to collect. Someone, perhaps Titus, had picked up the scattered stones from the lawn after the destruction of James's mandala on the night of the party. My stone border was comparatively undisturbed. I went and sat down too. The rocks were already warm. James had shaved. His face, reddened and browned by the sun, was very smooth above the dark stippling of his beard. He seemed somehow clearer and more visible than usual, or perhaps it was just that the light was better. His murky brown eyes were displaying their ochre-coloured streaks. His thin, clever lips were finely textured, ruddy. His dark hair more vital and glossy, hiding his bald spot. The mysterious mask resemblance to Aunt Estelle was more present than usual, though he was not smiling. "James, I want you to go. I want you all to go. Tomorrow, okay?" James frowned. "Only if you come, too. Come and stay with me in London." "No, I must stay here."
"Why?"
"I've got things to do."
"What?"
"Oh, this and that, things about the house. Maybe I'll sell it after all. I want to be by myself now. I'm all right." James picked up a stone from the trough, a golden-brown one with two light blue lines running around it.
"I like your collection of stones. Can I have this one?"
"Yes, of course." "So that's settled, is it? I'll tell the others."
"What are you going to do about Ben and Hartley?"
"Nothing. That's over."
"I don't believe you."
I shrugged my shoulders and was about to get up, only James held the sleeve of my shirt.
"Charles, tell me what you think you are going to do. I know you are planning to do something."
What indeed was I planning to do? I was in a state which I well knew was close to a sort of madness, and yet I was not mad. Some kinds of obsession, of which being in love is one, paralyze the ordinary free-wheeling of the mind. Its natural, open, interested, curious mode of being, which is sometimes persuasively defined as rationality. I was sane enough to know that I was in a state of total obsession, and that I could only think over and over again certain agonizing thoughts, could only run continually along the same rat paths of fantasy and intent. But I was not sane enough to interrupt this mechanical movement, or even to desire to do so. I wanted to kill Ben. When I say that I wanted to kill him, I do not mean that I had yet a definite plan, or a definite program with a date. That would come to me, and come soon once I was alone. The necessary period of sheer miserable brooding was over, and I would soon be able to make decisions. Ben had attempted to kill me. And it now amazed me, in retrospect, that I had been able so far to overlook or forgive this crime, this insult, as not to feel compelled to punish it as such. My late and now outdated plan to besiege Hartley by tramping in and out had had as its end her rescue, not his chastisement. I had proposed to intimidate him simply in order to get her away. To destroy him had not been my prime object, but now the situation was entirely different. I could not overlook the murder of Titus or let it go unavenged. Because I had failed to die, Ben had struck Titus on the head and drowned him. He had killed the boy out of pure hideous spite against me, and that he could be crazy enough to do so I could well believe, as I considered how crazy I now was myself. In truth, the basis of my madness was sheer grief, the loss of that precious, precious child, the horror of his sudden death, together with the sense of having been the victim of a wanton wickedness. The only balm for Titus's death was hatred, and the immediate transformation of misery into revengeful, purposeful rage. As in a civil war, further killing was the only consolation, and, as it seemed to me then, to survive the murder of Titus, I had to become a terrorist. During the last days, as I allowed myself to be quietly watched by James and Lizzie, and as I played my part of simple mourning, I had filled out in imagination how terribly Ben, with his mad beliefs, must have hated me, and because of me, Titus, throughout the miserable years of Titus's childhood. The connection between me and Titus in his mind must have become a dynamic obsessional pattern. The boy, continually before him, was, as he thought, the visible symbol of his wife's inconstancy, and of the jaunty, unpunished escape of the hated rival, whose jeering image he so regularly saw in the newspapers and on the television screen. Ben was a naturally violent man, a destroyer, a killer. How he must have loathed me and my changeling brat, and torn his own entrails with that loathing. Punishing the wife and the boy could never be enough while the prime culprit ran scot-free and laughing. Sheer hatred can be a commanding form of madness. Many and many a time in all those years, Ben must have killed me in his imagination. When we at last met, he was soon to see that his own violence and anger were matched by equally fierce emotions in me. He knew perfectly well of my impulse to push him in, on that occasion when we faced each other on the rocky bridge. He knew that I wanted him out of my way, and may have conjectured how very far I might in the end be prepared to go. He could even argue that he had tried to kill me in self-defence. Then when I had so disobligingly failed to die and was still there, taunting him with my free existence and brazenly protecting as my son the hated bratling, what could be more natural than that Ben's mad rage should turn against me through the boy, bringing about perhaps an even more satisfying act of vengeance? I recalled Ben's last words to me, wherein a curse on the vile brat was joined with, "I'll kill you." Could I now walk away into the world and get over this act? This fact? It was unthinkable. Act must match act. But how? In all these thoughts I was just sane enough to try to steady myself by the image of Hartley. I tried to see her face looking at me, wistful and calm, beautiful as it had once been and perhaps would be again. Later I would move to her and embrace her, and we would console each other at last. What I could not really get myself to see or feel, however, was just how the path through the destruction of Ben led to Hartley, or what exactly the destruction of Ben would be like. Now that I felt free to destroy him, I sometimes felt that I hated him even more obsessively than I loved her. At least I knew, watching my obsession, that I was not now wanting to remove him simply because of her. The removal had become an end in itself. Concerning what I was actually going to do, I had evolved a number of quite different plans, which were still more or less at the stage of being fantasies. When I was alone, I would have the concentration necessary to convert one of these into a practical proposition. I thought of going to the police. Someone had attempted to kill me, and an explanation of all the circumstances would point an unambiguous finger at Ben, and it would, I guessed, be in Ben's character to answer a formal or even hinted accusation with a defiant avowal of guilt. This indeed might be the simplest, easiest way to catch him. to open a big net and let him run straight into it. I saw Ben as a simple, aggressive man who would be made uneasy by the subtleties of the law, and would then scorn the refinements of lying. I played with this fantasy so much that the whole thing began to seem as good as done. On the other hand, if Ben did consistently deny the charge, I was certainly short of proof. I also, and equally, considered various mixtures of guile and violence. If I could lure him to the house, and push him into Min's cauldron, that would be the justest thing of all. But of course he would be too cautious to come. I considered other ways of drowning him. None was easy. I was more attracted by some straightforward sort of violence, which, however, could not be too straightforward, since Ben was a strong, dangerous man, and if he were to do me a serious damage while I was trying to damage him, I really would go mad with chagrin. An accomplice would help, but I had vowed to act without one. I had not forgotten what Hartley said about Ben having kept his army revolver. I had no doubt that he kept it oiled and polished, but he might have no ammunition. I possessed, but in London, a beautiful replica automatic property of the theatre. Suppose I were to hold him up with that, make him turn round, then hit him with a hammer. And then? Tell the whole story to the police? Get Hartley to testify that I did it in self-defence? As it was at every moment possible that Ben might make another attempt to kill me, my fantasy actions did in fact begin to look to me more and more like self-defence. Those who are caught in mental cages can often picture freedom. It just has no attractive power. I also knew, in the midst of it all, that some unexamined guilt of my own was driving me further into hatred. But this was no moment to be confused by guilt. As I moved like a ghost, performing in the house and its environs a sort of ritual dance under the eyes of James and Lizzie and Perry, I thought about Hartley, and I pictured peace with her in that little house where we would hide forever after. Yet if I did what I so intensely desired and consoled myself by desiring, if I destroyed Ben, if I killed him, or crippled him, or damaged his mind, or got him sent to prison, could I then walk away with Hartley in peace? What would that peace be like? What would the idea of justice be able to do for me afterwards? Was it not, under all these disguises, my own death that I was planning? I said to James, pulling away my sleeve, which he was still holding, "I am not going to do anything. I just feel all smashed up by misery. Come to London with me." "No. I can see you're scheming. Your eyes are full of awful visions. Sea serpents. Charles, tell me." These particular words brought back to me how extremely difficult I had found it to mislead James when I was a boy. He had a way of worming things out of one, as if the intended lie turned into truth on one's very lips. I was not going to tell now, however. How could I reveal to anyone the horrors that now crowded my mind? "James, go to London. I'll come later, soon. I'll come and sort out my flat. Don't torment me now. I just want a day or two of peace here by myself, that's all."
"You've got some awful idea."
"I have no idea. My mind is empty."
"You said something to me before, about imagining that Ben pushed you into the cauldron."
"Yes."
"But of course you don't really think that."
"I do. But it's not important any more." James was looking at me in a calculating way. Lizzie called from the kitchen that breakfast was ready. The sun shone calm and bright on the grass, refreshed by the rain, on the border of pretty stones, on the sparkling yellow rocks. It was a caricature of a happy scene.
"It is important," said James. "I don't want to leave you behind here with that totally false notion in your head.
Let's have breakfast."
"It is false, Charles."
"You sound quite passionate." "That's your view, and I have mine. Come on."
"Wait, wait. It's not just a view. I know. I know it wasn't Ben."
I stared at him. "James, you can't know. Did you see it happen?"
"No, I didn't, but..."
"Did someone else see it?"
"No."
"Then how can you know?"
"I just do. Charles, please, will you trust me? Surely you can trust me. Just don't ask any questions. Accept my statement that Ben didn't do it. Ben did not do it.
We stared at each other. The intensity of James's tone, his eyes, his fierce face, carried conviction into my resisting mind. But I could not believe him. How could he know this? Unless James himself had pushed me in. What, after all, lay behind that Red Indian mask? We had always been rivals for the world, I the more successful one. A childhood hatred, like a childhood love, can last a lifetime. James was an odd card, a funny man with a funny mind. He was in a ruthless profession. I recalled his respectful remarks about Ben. It might even be that he had tried to remove me simply because he knew I had guessed that he was a secret agent and was returning to Tibet. I put my hands to my head. I said, however, "Listen, James, and stop trying to impress me. Not only did Ben try to kill me, Ben killed Titus."
"Oh, Lord,"
said James. He turned away with an air of distracted hopelessness, then said, "What's your evidence for his having killed Titus? Did you see him?" "No, but it's obvious. No one examined that blow on the head. Titus was a strong swimmer, and when Ben had tried to murder me—"
"Yes, that's your evidence. But I know it isn't so."
"James, you can't know. I understand this man and how much he can hate. You were just gratified to see a fellow soldier. What I see is an able killer and a man absolutely consumed, mad with jealous spite, with a whole history of it. And I know what jealous spite is like."
"That's what I'm afraid of," said James. "Your spite. What can I swear upon that will satisfy you? I swear by our childhood, by the memory of our parents, by our cousinhood, that Ben did not do this thing. Will you not please just accept this and ask no more? Oh, let it all go now, let it go. Come to London, let's get out of this place."
"How can I accept it? I notice you argue that it wasn't Ben, but not that I imagined it all. Would you just accept the fact that some person unknown had tried to kill you? And you can't be sure it wasn't Ben. Unless, by any chance, it was you."
"It wasn't me," said James, frowning. "Don't be absurd."
I felt a ridiculous degree of relief. Had I then for a moment seriously entertained the idea that my cousin was filled with murderous hate against me? Of course I believed him at once, and of course it was absurd. But if it was not James, or, as he argued, Ben, who was it? I was impressed by his solemn oath, though I could not believe him. Gilbert, mad with secret jealousy because of Lizzie? Rosina, mourning for her lost child? Perhaps there were quite a lot of people with motives to murder me. Freddy Arkwright, why not? He hated me. He was now at a Mourne farm, where Ben had been to get the dog. Suppose Ben had hired Freddy to kill, or perhaps just maim me, and it had ended with that dreadful fall. James could see me speculating, and he made a hopeless gesture. "I'm no good at guessing games," I said. "I thought it was Ben, and I still think so."
"Come inside, then," said James,
and he rose. We came into the kitchen. Lizzie was standing at the stove. She had pinned her hair back, and was wearing a very short check overall over a very short dress. She looked ridiculously young, and had an anxious, silly schoolgirl look which she sometimes wore. Perry was sitting at the table with his legs stretched beneath it and his elbows upon it. His big face was already greasy with sweat, and his eyes were glazed. He might even have been drunk. James just said,
"Peregrine."
Peregrine said, without moving, his glazed eyes still staring ahead, "If you've been discussing who killed Charles, or failed to kill Charles, it was me."
"Perry! My name is Peregrine. But Peregrine! Why on earth? Did you really? Why?"
Lizzie moved, without surprise, sat down to watch. She evidently already knew.
"You ask why?" said Peregrine, without looking at me. "Just think why. Just think."
"You mean—"
"Good heavens.
You mean Rosina?"
"Yes. Oddly enough, I do. You deliberately smashed my marriage. You took away my wife, whom I adored.
You did it carefully, cold-bloodedly. You worked at it. Then when you had got her away from me, you dropped her. You didn't even want her for yourself. You just wanted to steal her from me to satisfy the beastly impulses of your possessiveness and your jealousy. Then when they were satisfied, when my marriage was broken forever, you went jaunting off somewhere else. And what is more, you expected me to tolerate this and to go on liking you. Why? Because you thought everybody always went on liking you, whatever rotten things you did, because you were wonderful, wonderful Charles Arabi. But, Peregrine, you yourself said to me more than once that you were glad to be rid of the bitch.
Okay.
But why did you believe me? And don't use that foul language, please. Of course, everyone knows you regard women as trash. But what bugged me was that you wrecked my life and my happiness, and you just didn't seem to care at all. You were so bloody perky. I don't believe you were happy. You just say so now. Oh, for Christ's sake! You took her out of sheer spiteful jealousy. Okay, I can be jealous too. But you yourself encouraged me to feel it was all right. Why did you bother to pretend and mislead me? You can't blame me now. If you had looked more stricken, I would have felt more guilty. But you were so nice to me, so friendly. You always seemed so pleased to see me. I am an actor. And perhaps I was pleased to see you. We sometimes like to see people whom we hate and despise so that we can stir them up to further demonstrations of how odious they are.
So you've been waiting all these years for revenge?
No, not like that. I enjoyed leading you on and just looking at you and gloating and thinking how surprised you'd be if you knew what I really felt. You've been a bad dream to me all these years. You've been with me like a demon, like a cancer.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. If you imagine I want to hear you apologizing now,
I may have behaved badly to you, but I didn't deserve to die for it.
No, all right. I admit it was an impulse and I was drunk. I just pushed you and walked on. I didn't really see what happened and I didn't care. But you said you were non-violent. You said you never... Okay, you were a special case. The last straw was seeing bloody Rosina suddenly sitting on top of that rock like a black witch. I thought you must still be carrying on with her. Well, obviously you are. I'm not. I don't care. I wondered why you stopped talking about her. You were planning to kill me. I don't care. I don't want to know. I don't believe anything you say. I think you're a worthless person. I just couldn't stand seeing her there, and the windscreen getting broken. I couldn't stand it. It was a shock. It made me feel mad. It made a sort of hole in me, and all the old stored-up hate came pouring out, and all the green-eyed jealousy as fresh as ever. I had to do something to you. I really just wanted to push you into the sea. I dare say I was pretty drunk. I didn't choose that spot. I didn't think it was that awful whirlpool, or whatever you call it.
Then you were lucky, weren't you? I might be dead.
Oh, I don't care, said Peregrine. I wish you were dead. I thought of calling you out. Only then I thought you might kill me instead because you drink less than I do. I suppose honour is satisfied now, anyway, and I won't have to offer you any more drinks, thank God. And I would even want to tell you what a four-letter man you are. You're an exploded myth, and you still think of Genghis Khan. Laissez-moi rire. I can't think why I let you haunt me all these years. I suppose it was just your power, and the endless spectacle of you doing well and flourishing like the green bay tree. Now you're old and done for, you'll wither away like Prospero did when he went back to Milan. You'll get pathetic and senile, and kind girls like Lizzie will visit you to cheer you up. At least they will for a while. You never did anything for mankind. You never did a damn thing for anybody except yourself. If Clement hadn't fancied you, no one would ever have heard of you. Your work wasn't any bloody good. It was just a pack of pretentious tricks, as everyone can see now that they aren't mesmerized anymore. So the glitter's fading fast, and you'll find yourself alone, and you won't even be a monster in anybody's mind anymore, and they'll all heave a sigh of relief and feel sorry for you, and forget you.
There was a moment's silence.
I said, "But if you're so pleased about it, why tell? You only had to keep quiet. Or did you want me to know? I don't care what you know or don't know. Your cousin got it out of me by one of his interrogation techniques. He said you thought it was Ben, and you were working yourself up. You pretend you always detested me. It isn't true. You aren't all that good an actor. You told me about your Uncle Peregrine.
I have no Uncle Peregrine."
I felt totally confused. I said, "But what about Titus?"
"What do you mean?"
said James. "What happened to Titus? Who killed Titus? I mean, I thought...
Surely Ben killed him."
Lizzie answered this after a moment. She said,
"Charles, it was an accident. No one killed him."
Peregrine got up. He said,
"Well, that's that. That's sorted that out, and I hope the General is satisfied. I'm going back to London. Goodbye, Lizzie. Nice to have seen you."
He marched out, and I could hear him collecting his things. Then there was the sound of the Alfa Romeo backing violently onto the causeway, and then its diminishing roar. James had got up and was looking out of the window. Lizzie, soundlessly crying, was filling the kettle at the tap. She put it on the stove and turned the gas up. I said to James, "You said you didn't want to leave me behind here with a false notion in my head. Well, now it's gone. So there's nothing to detain you." James turned round.
"Won't you come to London?"
"No."
"But what are you going to do about them?"
"Nothing. It's over. It's over." But of course that was not true. That day and the next day passed in a sick trance, a period of time which seemed like the peace of resignation and hopeless, quiet mourning, but was really full of fear and venom. I passionately wanted James to go. His appearance, his company, his obtrusive, unseen presence irritated me into torments. Lizzie irritated me too, partly by her frequent tears, which she seemed unable to control, and partly by a silly, beseeching, sympathetic expression which she put on when I looked at her, and which made me suddenly see the picture which Peregrine had sketched of me as an aging, powerless ex-magician for whom people were sorry. I could understand why Lizzie refused to go. She wanted to be in at the kill. She was waiting for the moment when I could stand no more and would turn to her helplessly to be seized and carried off. Why James wanted to hang around was less clear. He certainly believed what I told him, that I no longer regarded Ben as a murderer. He might suspect that I had not given up my idea of rescuing Hartley, but after all he could not go on watching me forever. It was quite plain that I was not proposing to return to London in his Bentley. A little tact, and he was not usually deficient in tact, might have prompted him now to leave me and Lizzie alone. He did not even seem to want to talk to me any more. It was as if he was staying on for some purpose of his own. I guessed that he was brooding on Titus and somehow blaming himself, as I blamed myself for not having attended more to what the boy was doing. At this time I avoided the rocks and the sea, but James was always out there, walking about on the cliff, standing on Min's bridge, and climbing up to the tower, almost as if he were measuring the distances involved. On several afternoons Lizzie and I walked inland, past the place where in a previous existence I had intended to put my herb garden, into the country which I had never explored. The region just beyond the road was bog, full of outcrops of rock and gorse and little black pools. There were some scrappy heather and a lot of those tiny yellow plants that catch flies, and purple and white flowers that looked like miniature orchids. Two pairs of buzzards inhabited the blue air. After the bog, there was ordinary farmland, sheep scattered hillsides, distant mustard fields catching the sunlight with their huge patches of glowing yellow. There were many ruined stone cottages, roofless and full of willow herb, and wild buddleia and butterflies, and we came on the ruin of a big house, with the box hedges of the formal garden grown into a forest and covered with rambler roses. I record these details, which I recall so clearly, because they are the very image of sorrow, things seen which might have given pleasure, but could not. I saw through a black veil of misery and remorse, and indecision, and fear, and there was a feeling as if I carried a small leaden coffin in the place of my heart. Lizzie, walking with me, had wept her fill for Titus, and was still often weeping, but now more privately and self-indulgently. With a woman's economy in grief, I could feel her tentacles clasping me. Lizzie was not going to perish, not for anyone, if she could help it. If I had fallen dead, she would soon have been crying in someone else's arms. These are unkind words, but I felt a special, localized bitterness against Lizzie then, because I knew how temporary her affliction was, and how soon, if I required her sympathy, it could turn into a possessive triumph. Lizzie is one of those very sweet, very kind, kittenish women whom men love for their sympathetic gentleness, but who have a truly relentless power